All right, so ready to dive into some seriously cool stuff. Today, we're cracking codes. Well, not us personally, but, getting into the nitty-gritty of cryptanalysis. Basically, how do people break the codes that are supposed to keep things safe online and all that?
It's a bit like being a digital detective, figuring out the secrets hidden within those ones and zeros.
Right. And I bet it's way more intense than those Hollywood movie montages make it seem.
Oh, absolutely. We're talking about strategies that are, well, some are shockingly simple and some are, honestly, kind of scary smart.
Well, let's start with the simple stuff. Like, we've all seen that movie scene, right? Someone's trying to crack a safe, timer's ticking down, and they're just frantically trying every single combination.
That's brute force, yeah.
Exactly. About as subtle as using a sledgehammer to open a walnut. But you'd be surprised how often it works in the digital world. The real kicker is the length of the key, a short PIN, piece of cake.
Right.
But add a few more characters, and suddenly you're talking about combinations that would take a computer longer than the universe has existed to try. So, like, my 10-character password is basically Fort Knox compared to a 4-digit PIN?
Pretty much. Now, imagine trying to crack a code with no key at all, just the scrambled message itself. That's ciphertext only, and it's a whole different ballgame.
Okay, that just sounds impossible. How can you crack a code without any clues about the original message? That's like, what do you even DO?
It's incredibly tough, like trying to decipher an alien language with no Rosetta Stone to help you. The only hope is to find patterns in the gibberish, hoping it reveals something about the language, the type of code, any little hint.
So in the real world, these ciphertext-only attacks, they're not that common.
Not really. Not with the encryption we have these days. It's just not practical. But where things get really interesting is with known plaintext attacks.
Known plaintext. So in this case, you actually have a piece of the puzzle already figured out.
Exactly. If an attacker gets their hands on both a regular message A and D, its encrypted version, well, they might be able to figure out the key. Think of it like having the enemy's battle plans. Suddenly, winning the war is a lot easier.
And once they've got the key, that's it, right? Any other message using the same key is toast.
Bingo. Like finding the master key to a giant mansion, all the doors are now wide open. But let's switch gears for a sec. Not all attacks are about brute force. Some are more about finesse, like frequency analysis.
Frequency analysis. Okay, that sounds a little too simple. What is that? Like counting how many times each letter appears in a message.
You're on the right track. It's all about those patterns again. See, human languages, they have their quirks. Like in English, E is the most common letter, right? So in a long enough coded message, the symbol that appears most often, probably E.
Wow. So you're basically using the structure of language itself against it. That's kind of poetic when you think about it.
And effective, especially when you add computers to the mix. They can analyze tons of data and spot those patterns in a flash. Makes those old code-breaking machines from the war look like toys.
Okay, this is already blowing my mind, and we're just getting started. But speaking of spy stuff, what about those chosen ciphertext attacks? Those sound like something straight out of Mission Impossible.
All right, imagine this. You're not just trying to break a code. You're tricking your target into doing it for you. You craft a special message, get them to decrypt it, and boom, you learn the secrets of their whole system.
Hold on, so it's like setting a trap? But the trap is a message.
Precisely. You're using their system against itself. It's where the idea of malleable encryption comes. And some encryption methods are so sensitive that even tiny changes you make to the coded message will cause predictable changes when it's decoded.
That sounds incredibly complex. So you're basically exploiting the way the encryption itself works, not just attacking it head on.
You got it. That's the beauty of a chosen ciphertext attack.
Okay, that's some next level stuff. But what about those vulnerabilities that aren't in the code itself, but in how it's used? Like you were talking about implementation attacks earlier.
Ah, yes. It's like having Fort Knox, but leaving the key under the welcome mat. A buggy program, outdated hardware, heck, even storing an encryption key in an insecure place. These little details can be a huge gift to attackers.
So you could have the strongest encryption in the world, but if it's set up wrong, it's about as useful as a screen door on a submarine.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And then there are side channel attacks, which are even sneakier. They're not about the code itself, but about the information that leaks out during the encryption or decryption process.
Wait, hold on. Information leaks? Like what kind of information are we talking about here?
Think about how a computer works, the time it takes to do a calculation, the power it uses, even the electromagnetic radiation it gives off. These can all be measured. Take cache timing attacks, for example.
Cache timing attacks. You're going to have to break that one down for me.
Okay, so computers use a cache to store frequently accessed data, right? Well, a cache timing attack measures those tiny, tiny differences in how long it takes the processor to access data in the cache. By analyzing those variations, an attacker might be able to figure out your encryption key, all without ever directly attacking the encryption itself.
That sounds unbelievably difficult to pull off. Like, you'd need to be some kind of tech wizard to even attempt that, right?
It's definitely more complex than, say, brute forcing a four-digit PM.
Yeah.
But it just goes to show security isn't just about strong algorithms. It's about how those algorithms are used and the entire system they run on. Every little detail matters.
So it's about the big picture, not just the code itself. Man, this is way more complicated than I ever imagined.
We're just getting started.
I can't wait to hear more.
All right, so remember those side channel attacks we were talking about? Well, fault injection attacks are where we crank things up a notch. We're talking about deliberately messing with a system to make it crack. Imagine you have this system humming along, processing encrypted data. Now, what happens if you introduce a tiny error? A voltage spike, a temperature fluctuation, maybe.
Isn't that super risky? Like, wouldn't that just break the whole thing?
That's the whole point.
Yeah.
Sometimes that little glitch, that fault, it can cause the system to trip up, to deviate from its programming, and in doing so, it might just spit out some information it wasn't supposed to.
So you're saying you're exploiting the system's error handling. Like, when it tries to recover from that glitch, it accidentally reveals something important.
You got it. It's like giving a vending machine just the right bump to make it spill out a free snack.
Mm-hmm.
But let's shift gears a bit from the world of microscopic glitches to, well, time itself. Have you ever heard of timing attacks?
Vaguely. But I'll be honest, the idea of attacking time sounds like something out of Doctor Who.
It might sound strange, but it's a real thing. It all comes down to the fact that even the fastest computer on Earth, it still takes time to process information. Even those tiny, tiny fractions of a second can be a gold mine for a clever attacker.
Okay, I need an example. How could someone actually use time to break a code? Like, what does that even look like?
Let's say you're using your online banking app, right? Everything's encrypted, secure, all that. Now, imagine an attacker sending a bunch of carefully crafted requests to the bank's server, measuring exactly how long it takes to process each one.
Hold on. So they're not attacking the encryption directly. They're looking for, what, patterns in how long things take.
Exactly. Those tiny timing differences can reveal a surprising amount of information. It might be enough to figure out parts of your encryption key, maybe even the content of your transaction.
That's both amazing and terrifying. So much for time being on our side, huh?
Right. It's, like I said, cryptanalysis is all about finding those subtle weaknesses, those little cracks in the armor that let you slip past even the toughest defenses. Speaking of real-world scenarios, let's talk about man-in-the-middle attacks. Remember those spy movies we were talking about earlier?
Oh, yeah. This is where things get really sneaky, right? So, like, I'm sending a message, all encrypted. I think it's going straight to my bank. But then what? What's the man in the middle doing?
Picture this. You're at a coffee shop, connect to the Wi-Fi, totally normal, right? But what you don't realize is that it's a rogue hotspot set up by an attacker. You're sending data, receiving data, but instead of going straight to the bank, it's passing through their system first.
Wait, so they're essentially eavesdropping on my entire conversation with the bank, even though it's encrypted?
And then some. They can not only see the data, but potentially manipulate it, too. It's like having someone secretly listening in on your phone calls and changing the words you hear in real time.
Okay, that's officially terrifying. So using a VPN, that can help protect against this kind of attack, right?
Absolutely. A VPN is like creating a secret tunnel for your data, making it much harder for someone to intercept it. But let's move on to another attack that plays on our assumptions about security past the hash attacks.
Right. We talked about this one a bit beforehand. It's like stealing the keys to the kingdom, but instead of a physical key, it's this hash thing.
Exactly. Think of a hash as a digital fingerprint for your password. When you make an account online, they don't usually store your actual password. They store this hash. It's a one-way function, meaning it's easy to make a hash from a password, but nearly impossible to do the reverse.
So even if someone steals the hash, they can't just reverse engineer it to get my actual password.
In theory, no. But attackers are clever. They figured out ways to use those stolen hashes to bypass the whole password thing altogether. It's like finding someone's driver's license. You might not be able to forge their signature, but you can still use it to impersonate them.
Okay, I'm starting to see how this works, but it seems like if the hash can be used against you, what's the point of even having a password?
That, my friend, is the million-dollar question in cybersecurity.
Yeah.
It's a constant arms race. That's why we have things like multi-factor authentication now. But let's shift gears again and talk about another area ripe for this kind of attack, Kerberos exploitation.
Kerberos, right. That's a type of authentication protocol, like a digital bouncer that checks your ID before letting you into a network.
You got it. It's everywhere, especially in large companies. Think of Kerberos as the gatekeeper to a digital kingdom, guarding all sorts of valuable data and resources. And like any good gatekeeper, it's got its weaknesses.
Weaknesses that attackers can exploit, I'm assuming.
Oh, absolutely. One way is through a technique called overpass the hash, which is pretty similar to the pass the hash attack we talked about earlier. See, even if a network disables the older, less secure NTLM protocol, each system still tends to generate an NTLM hash.
So like a just-in-case kind of thing.
Exactly. And attackers know this. They can use that NTLM hash to get what's called a ticket-granting ticket, or TGT, from the Kerberos system.
Okay, hold on. A TGT, does it grant wishes, too?
Think of it as a digital all-access pass within the network. Once an attacker has a TGT, they can basically impersonate any user they want and access all sorts of things they shouldn't have access to.
And this is just one type of ticket they can get their hands on.
Oh, there are more. There's the silver ticket, which is even more powerful. And then there's the holy grail, the golden ticket.
Golden ticket? Sounds delicious. I'd like one of those.
Attackers would love to get their hands on one. With the golden ticket, they basically become the master key maker of the network. They can forge any access pass they want, no questions asked.
It sounds like securing a network that uses Kerberos is a full-time job, like protecting a castle with walls within walls.
You're not wrong. And we haven't even touched on the simpler attacks. Brute forcing Kerberos logins, basically just guessing usernames and passwords over and over again, it's surprisingly common. And then there's something called ASRAP roasting, which targets systems that haven't been properly secured.
So even with a system like Kerberos, which seems super complex, it still comes down to basic security hygiene.
100%. It's a never-ending battle between attackers looking for holes and defenders trying to patch them up. But Kerberos isn't the only target out there. Let's talk about Kerber roasting, which takes aim at service accounts.
Service accounts. So we're not even talking about human users anymore.
Nope. These are accounts used by applications and services to access resources on a network. They often have elevated privileges, which makes them very attractive targets. With Kerber roasting, an attacker tricks the Kerberos system into handing out ticket-granting service tickets, basically special access passes, just for those service accounts.
And I'm guessing these tickets are somehow vulnerable.
You're catching on. The issue is that service accounts often have passwords that are either weak or rarely changed. And since those TGS tickets are encrypted with the service account's password, well, they become a prime target for cracking.
So they steal a bunch of these tickets, crack them offline at their leisure, and then, bam, they have access to whatever those service accounts could access.
You got it. It's a pretty clever attack, and it just goes to show you got to have strong passwords and good security practices, even for those accounts that nobody really thinks about.
Man, the deeper we get into this world of cryptanalysis, the more I realize how much I don't know.
It's a lot to take in, for sure. And believe it or not, we've only scratched the surface. But speaking of scary things, let's talk about something that's been in the news a lot lately. Ransomware.
Ransomware, it's like the monster under the bed of the internet. You know, everyone's heard of it. Nobody wants to actually think about it. What makes it so different from everything else we've talked about?
You know, in a way, it's not really a new attack, ransomware. It's more like a new way of doing business using those old tricks. Think phishing emails, weak passwords, those software exploits we talked about. That's how they usually get in.
So it's not so much about breaking in. It's what they do once they're inside that's different.
Exactly. See, with ransomware, they're not just trying to steal your data. They want to hold it hostage. They encrypt everything, lock you out of your own digital life.
And that's when the ransom demand comes in, right? Pay up or say goodbye to your files.
Pretty much. They demand payment, usually in cryptocurrency because it's harder to trace. And here's the kicker. Even if you pay, no guarantee they'll actually give you the decryption key. You're trusting a criminal to keep their word. Not exactly a recipe for peace of mind.
It's terrifying, honestly, especially for businesses, people who need that data to function. But didn't the government say something about paying the ransom that it might not even be legal in some cases?
That's right. The OFAC, they put out this advisory basically saying that if you pay the ransom to certain groups, you might be breaking the law.
Wait, seriously? So you could be in legal trouble on top of everything else?
It's a messed up situation all around. It shows how this stuff, Cybersecurity, it's not just about ones and zeros. It's got real-world consequences.
Mm.
Legal stuff, international relations. We all have a part to play in stopping these guys.
It's like ransomware is the perfect example of how cryptanalysis, this whole world of code breaking, it's not just some abstract thing. It affects all of us.
100%. In this day and age, the security of our data, our privacy, it all comes down to understanding these threats, knowing how to protect ourselves.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground today. Everything from brute force attacks to that Kerberos thing, which still sounds a little bit like a mythical creature to me, to, well, the very real threat of ransomware.
It's been quite the deep dive. Hopefully everyone listening has a little more awareness now about what goes on behind the scenes of cybersecurity.
Before we wrap up, are there any other code-breaking tricks, any other tools in the cryptanalyst's toolbox that we haven't had time to get to?
Oh, are there ever? We could spend hours talking about replay attacks, where an attacker records a transmission and then, like, rewinds it to gain access. Or dictionary attacks, where they literally just try every word in the dictionary until they crack the code. Not exactly subtle,
right,
but surprisingly effective.
Right. And then there are those implementation attacks, like that WEP thing we talked about, where the encryption algorithm itself is strong, but it's used so poorly that it's basically useless.
Exactly. Like they say, a chain is only as strong as its weakest link.
So many ways to break a code. It's almost poetic in a weird way.
Oh, there's plenty more. We've got rainbow tables, birthday attacks. It's a whole thing.
See, I told you high school math would come in handy someday. But seriously, the complexity here is incredible.
It's a fascinating field, really, this intersection of math, computer science, even psychology.
Oh, right, because sometimes the easiest way to break a code isn't to hack a computer, it's to hack a person.
Social engineering, right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Tricking someone into giving up their password or, I don't know, letting you plug a USB drive into their computer. Human error is often the weakest link.
We've talked about a lot of clever tricks today, but it's important to remember the human cost of all of this. It's not just a game, right?
Absolutely not. And it's not always pretty either. There are even darker methods out there. Things like purchase key attacks, where you literally just bribe someone for the key. Or worse, rubber hose cryptanalysis, which is as brutal as it sounds. So this whole world of cryptanalysis, it's fascinating, it's complex, and yeah, it's got a dark side too.
For sure. It's a constant battle between those who want to protect information and those who want to exploit it. And as our world becomes more digital, the stakes just get higher and higher.
And on that note, I think it's time to wrap up this deep dive. We've explored the hows, the whys, and the whats of code breaking. And I think it's safe to say cybersecurity is way more complicated than it seems. But if there's one thing to take away from all of this, it's that in this digital age, knowledge is power.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
So until next time, stay curious, stay safe, and thanks for listening.